This is KGNU's Morning Magazine. It's Tuesday, September 27th of 2022. I'm your host, Shannon Young. Thank you for joining us here on listener-supported community radio. Coming up on today's program, Boulder says it's working towards a zero-waste goal, but how's it going, really? Our latest story in the Follow the Waste series looks at how food vendors fared in this year's zero-waste audit. This Week in Water is taking a break, so we'll stick with the waste and speak with a plastics expert about why recycling in the U.S. is so inconsistent from city to city. And we'll go to our comment line to hear what's on the minds of listeners. At the bottom of the hour, we'll have an update from the BBC News headlines. Then it's How on Earth? Coming up on The Science Show, you'll learn about gut reactions, from the effects of air quality on the microbiome to the ability of proteins to fold quickly and efficiently into very complex shapes. At 9 a.m. comes another archival recording of a lecture by the late British philosopher Alan Watts. Then at 9:30, Joanne Cole will be in the Boulder studio for the Morning Sound Alternative. All that's still ahead, but first it's time for local and regional headlines with KGNU's Luis Licon.
Denver's Department of Housing Stability is planning to purchase a former La Quinta Inn and convert it into homeless shelters. The former motel has provided 103 rooms of non-congregate shelter and unhoused people since the start of the pandemic in April of 2020. Denver officials announced Monday that the city will use $5 million of funding it received from the American Rescue Plan Act to finance the purchase. Current plans call for transitional housing through the 2024 year, with a vision to redevelop the site of 200 supportive housing units. Denver Mayor Hancock stated in a press release, "Leveraging hotel sites like this is paramount to creating more housing for our unhoused neighbors. This redevelopment is a part of a 5-year strategic plan to produce more than 900 units in the coming years to house people without homes." Environmental groups are calling on the state and federal leaders to halt the Suncor Line 1 Rocky Mountain Pipeline project, citing concerns about increased air and water pollution and impacts on communities of color. Eric Gladys has more.
More than 40 environmental groups are urging federal regulators and Colorado's congressional delegation to put a pause on a pipeline project underway in Weld County called Line 1 that would nearly triple the current capacity to deliver crude oil to the Suncor refinery in Commerce City. Patricia Garcia-Nelson with the group Green Latinos says if officials allow the extension of Line 1 to continue, they essentially will be rewarding bad behavior.
Suncor has a history of being a problematic operator. They violated pollution limits. They had been operating under an expired permit since 2011.
Last week, the group sent formal petitions to federal regulators warning that the project will increase greenhouse gas emissions and the toxic burden on an already heavily polluted community living near the refinery. The pipeline will cross the South Platte River, which supplies water for eastern Colorado and downstream states, and a 100-year floodplain. Suncor says it has no plans to increase capacity with the new pipeline and argues it will reduce emissions from trucks carrying crude. Garcia-Nelson argues the project will undermine Colorado's efforts to meet climate targets and realize goals in the Colorado Environmental Justice Act passed by lawmakers last year. Because Line 1 replaces an existing pipeline, the project is going forward without public input on its potential impacts on communities, air and water quality, and climate change. But Garcia-Nelson says that won't stop her group and others from trying to stop it. This is Eric Gladys reporting for the Colorado News Connection.
A new law meant to expand protections for mobile home residents will take effect on October 1st. HB 22-1287 passed in late May, but only after a veto threat from Governor Jared Polis forced sponsors to remove a critical provision to cap rent hikes on mobile home lots. The new law builds on a previous protection on mobile home legislation that gives residents 90 to 180 days to pool resources to buy parks from landlords interested in selling their land. The law also adds more responsibility to landlords to maintain their parks and liability for damage caused to a home. Many housing activists criticize Governor's veto threat, given his rhetorical support for affordable housing. According to the Colorado Newsline, about 100,000 mobile homes in Colorado are spread across the state. In Boulder, the intersection of 30th and Colorado has reopened. It closed for 2 weeks as work crews constructed an underground bike lane and pedestrian walkways. The construction, which started in March of 2021, is part of a $16 million project designed to improve connections on sidewalks and bike lanes in high-traffic areas. More information has come out regarding the death of an Arvada police officer who was killed earlier this month while responding to a dispute between a man and a woman. Police were called after an argument over the custody of a couple's mutual children turned violent. Shortly after Officer Dylan Vekoff arrived on the scene, the assailant Sonny Thomas Alamanza III allegedly shot Vekoff in the head. Alamanza reportedly argued that he was unaware that Vekoff was a police officer. Police say Alamanza also fired another shot that wounded his partner's sister in the leg. Alamanza faces 11 felony counts, including 2 counts of first-degree murder and second-degree assault. The Colorado Department of Transportation is beginning repairs of an overpass near Meade, where a truck carrying an excavator crashed into a bridge, causing the death of a woman who was passing by in her vehicle last month. The family of the deceased woman is filing a wrongful death lawsuit against Import Towing and Recovery, the Fort Collins-based towing company who owned the truck. According to an investigation, the lawsuit alleges that the trucking company did not adequately secure the excavator on the truck or ensure it met proper height requirements before colliding with the overpass. The attorney's family, Michael Kane, said to CBS Colorado that to disregard the most basic safety regulation and go on a crowded interstate and have your load strike a bridge such that it kills somebody, we believe, as the lawsuit says, that conduct goes beyond negligence and it is reckless. CBS Colorado reached out to the trucking company for comments but did not respond. Today in Boulder, we are going to see a high of 76 and a low of 46 with a current temperature of 56 degrees. In Denver, there's going to be a high of 78 and a low of 56 with a current temperature of 54 degrees. In Fort Collins, there's going to be a high of 79 and a low of 47 with a current temperature of 50 degrees. For KGNU, I am Luis Licon.
You are listening to The Morning Magazine. I'm your host, Shannon Young. After a COVID-related break, Boulder has reinstated a requirement that food businesses report what they're doing to comply with the city's zero-waste ordinance. Restaurants, grocery stores, coffee shops, and almost all other businesses involved with food are supposed to be doing their part to reduce waste. As part of our Follow the Waste series, Sam Fuqua reports on how some businesses are responding.
Visitors to Boulder's Pearl Street Pedestrian Mall can find a trio of trash cans along the length of the walkway, one for compost, another for recyclables, and the last for landfill waste. It's part of a city effort to minimize trash under what's called the Universal Zero Waste Ordinance. Passed by the City Council back in 2015, it has 3 parts. All property owners, residential and commercial, are required to subscribe to separate collection services for trash, recyclables, and compost. Another part of the ordinance sets zero waste rules for special events. And finally, the ordinance sets a number of requirements for any business that deals with food. There are close to 400 of those in the city.
Business owners are required to provide separated collection systems within their businesses for the 3 separated waste streams, compostable materials, recycling, and trash.
Sandy Briggs is a sustainability program manager for the city. She oversees the business compliance with the ordinance. Briggs says businesses are also required to check in with the city every year via an online report.
Businesses are required to complete a zero waste reporting form, which can be easily found on the Universal Zero Waste Ordinance website and other places, that asks them to demonstrate through photos their compliant collection systems within their businesses that we can look at, and asks a few other general questions about who their waste hauler is and whether they believe that that service is adequate that they're receiving.
Over at Ozo Coffee on East Arapaho, the required bins are just inside the entrance. Ty Harrell is one of the managers for the local company, which has 5 locations in Boulder County.
So we have our recycling bin, which we can take bottles, any paper like newspapers or magazines, cartons such as juice boxes or milk cartons, you know, your standard recycling items that I think we're all familiar with. And then we have our compostable bin, which can take any food items, can take our paper and plastic cups that we use for to-go service, and then our landfill bin, which sometimes is a catch-all, unfortunately.
Harold says the zero waste compliance and reporting rules are just two of many requirements businesses have to deal with, but it's part of being serious about sustainability as a company.
It can get hairy, I know, like every month with the amount of things that businesses have to keep track of and stay on top of. Submitting things like that can be tough. Thankfully, though, for us, you know, we have a great team of people, and being that it's kind of our culture as a company is to always be maintaining, you know, our sustainability goals. We do a pretty good job, I think, of staying on top of those things.
But not all businesses are staying on top of it. Sandy Briggs from the city says that 138 restaurants and grocery stores submitted their zero waste compliance form by the August 31st reporting deadline. That's a little more than one-third of the 384 food businesses in town. Briggs says there won't be any penalties right away for businesses that didn't file on time.
There'll be lots of reminders, and there's lots of help and advising. We much prefer to not enforce this and to actually just help people through consulting and advising to get it right. So no, there will not be any immediate fees or anything like that.
But the zero waste ordinance does say that businesses may receive fines for noncompliance. That would be a last resort. The city partners with Boulder County's PACE program to help businesses move toward zero waste. PACE stands for Partners for a Clean Environment. And the city's zero waste website includes a handbook for businesses and training videos for employees in English and in Spanish. Businesses can also get free signs and compost bags. To make things a little easier and reduce the amount of contaminated compost, the city recently dropped the requirement that food businesses have a compost bin for their customers. They must still collect compost from their kitchens and behind the counters, but they only need to put two bins out front for customers, a recycle bin and a landfill bin. The two largest grocery store chains in Boulder, Safeway and King Soopers, did not respond to interview requests for this story. But at one of the smallest food markets in town, the focus is on creating less waste up front, so there's less that needs to be recycled or composted. From a storefront on East Walnut, Nude Foods offers groceries and prepared food with almost no packaging. Rachel Irons is one of the co-founders.
It's much better to reuse things than to recycle them and use all the energy to break things down and then create another product that's usually of inferior quality.
So any product sold at Nude Foods that needs a container is in a glass jar, or customers can bring their own receptacle. In addition to reducing waste, Irons says that approach can head off consumer confusion around what types of packaging can be recycled or composted.
There's a lot of wish cycling, as they call it, which is people don't want to feel guilty about throwing things away. So even if they're not sure if it can be recycled or composted, they're like, oh, I'll just throw it in there and someone will figure it out down the line. But they won't. You're just making more problems. And it's better to just put it in the trash if you don't know where it's going.
Boulder's Zero Waste Strategic Plan sets a target of 85% waste diversion by 2025. Many neighboring cities have also set zero waste goals. Fort Collins is a bit more ambitious than Boulder's, while Denver is aiming lower with a goal of 70% diversion by 2032. Boulder's current waste diversion is at 53%, a long way to go to get to the 85% goal in 3 years. For KGNU, I'm Sam Fuqua in Boulder.
This reporting series was made possible by a grant from Boulder County's Zero Waste Funding Program. Look in the garbage in any city or town, and chances are, plastics make up a big part of what is in the waste. Some of that is due to people throwing away recyclable items. Other times, it's because the plastic can't be reused or because the area doesn't have a facility that can recycle it. Why does this vary from town to town? To answer these questions, I spoke with a plastics expert, Kate O'Neill. She's a professor in global environmental governance and global waste in the Department of Environmental Science, Policy, and Management at UC Berkeley.
We do recycling, but we don't have any national laws around recycling. It's all local, and it's a big mess. It's patchwork. While the European Union has this amazing, like, circular economy platform, so everything has kind of got these centrally controlled rules and targets, and it works pretty well. Ours works not as well, but the divergence isn't as big as you think, but they're both based on the same science. They've just got different ways in which that science becomes policy.
Now, from a policy perspective, why don't we have something that's a centrally standardized form of recycling at a nationwide level in the U.S.?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, we really should. I mean, because production and recycling all happen in different places and affect different people. I guess the short version of a very long story is that waste management began in cities. And often, if you look at history of cities, that's often one of the reasons why city government exists. It was the first thing that they did was collecting waste and trash and, I guess, horse manure, all of those things. And so it really evolved bottom up. And so it's just been one of those areas where the federal government has not had the bandwidth to really intervene, but also has been very much come up from local levels, local preferences, local politics, local policies of getting rid of the kind of criminal elements that were running waste disposal in many cases. It's never really been pulled together. And now it's just this big, complex, very localized system.
Are there commercial interests or moneyed interests that benefit from there not being a standardized system in place?
I mean, it's although we have many, many different kinds of systems, there's really only a couple, maybe three or four really big waste management companies, waste management being one. I think Republic is another. So, yeah, they're able to work in all of these jurisdictions and to some extent, you know, work very differently with different communities, make money in different ways. I'm not going to say they're unscrupulous or anything, but it's definitely an industry that has a lot of political clout. But, yeah, there's a ton of money to be made in trash. And it's something that people don't think about. They think, oh, we just throw it away. The haulers take it. They put it somewhere. But they don't think about the whole world where these things are collected and then they're sold on to be, you know, to be recycled, to become other things. It's a big complicated world. A lot of money is made and we don't really have a clear picture of what's going on.
What are some of the limitations and perhaps myths that need to be dispelled when it comes to just consuming more than is necessary with a clear conscience?
Right. I think that, again, people have thought for a long time, oh, we can just recycle the plastic, the food, whatever it is that we have, the glass, the paper, so we can just keep buying it. And I think for a long time, people just sort of believed that recycling was the way that this was being solved. And we've flipped to the other end of the continuum now, that I think with realizing that there really aren't great markets for a lot of recycled goods. Plastics, for instance, you know, there's been so much publicity, plastics in the ocean, that we're realizing a lot of it is just getting thrown out. And the statistic that only, 9% of plastics get recycled worldwide, and maybe that's 4% of plastic waste in the United States, is giving people pause and realizing that, no, plastics we're not really working with as effectively. I think that means that we still need to look at the rest of the recycling system as some of it's functional, some of it isn't. Aluminum cans, still very recyclable, for instance. Paper, cardboard, not too bad. Glass, not at all. I used to think, oh, well, you know, we can't recycle plastic, but we can recycle glass. And in fact, glass is one of the hardest things to recycle effectively and economically. And it's not got a lot of uses as on a larger scale. So I think there's a lot of sort of complications around recycling and the effort you might have to go to clean your recyclables and not contaminate different loads. And it's actually kind of a bit exhausting for most people to think about. I know that communities like Berkeley, Boulder, others, that people really sort of want to be educated and want to do something, but it becomes really hard for them to think about. And then sometimes we just don't know where it goes.
Colorado has tried to shift some of the responsibility for plastic waste onto the producers. Is this part of a nationwide trend?
Yeah, it is part of a nationwide trend. And as always, it's not federal yet, although there are some bills in progress, but it is at the state level. So this is called what's called extended producer responsibility. And the idea, and again, this comes from Europe and some other places, is that one of the best ways to stop pollution and to create more environmentally sound packaging or other kind of products is to get the people who produce it to have to pay to dispose of it. And that's a pretty powerful incentive. Traditionally, it's been used effectively in mattresses. That is something we don't even think about in this context, but they're taken back by the manufacturers who have to deal with them, and they often reuse components and electronic goods. So now this is being applied to plastic packaging. And a couple of states have already introduced legislation. That would be Maine and Oregon, I know specifically. Sounds like Colorado is moving in that direction. And so probably most significantly of all is California. And I think this, again, is a potential game changer if it works correctly and is properly kind of implemented and monitored, and that you'll have companies like who even, not just the ones based in California, Colorado, Maine, or Oregon, but the ones that are, that anyone who ships plastics to these places will have to be responsible for either taking them back directly, or I think Maine's, part of Maine's legislation is that they pay fees into a local fund that will pay for better recycling facilities in Maine itself. So I think that this is one of those sort of areas of intervention that can be potentially very successful and kind of gets industry to think directly, pay direct costs rather than pass those costs on to others about what they produce, how they produce packaging, and what they sell their goods in, for instance.
Well, we are coming up on time. I just wanted to give you a chance to say anything that perhaps you want listeners to know that I didn't ask.
Well, I think the most important thing, and maybe, you know, I probably said it, and it certainly comes through in everything I do, which is wastes. Don't just throw them out and stop thinking about them. They have an afterlife, not just plastics, but your clothes, your electronics, food, anything that gets thrown out. There's something that happens to it afterwards, and quite often that involves people making money. And I also think it's important to think about who's doing that work. I love sort of sitting around my neighborhoods looking, well, who's picking up the trash? Who might be, you know, kind of rifling through your recycling and taking that, and understanding that there's a whole trash economy in which we live but is not visible. So I find that really exciting to think about. And as a little exercise that I tell my students to go do wherever they are.
Kate O'Neill, professor in global environmental governance and global waste at UC Berkeley. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Thanks for having me on.
We now check in with KGNU's comment line and the listeners who share their thoughts about what they hear on KGNU.
Hi. Last time on the International Press Roundtable, it was mentioned that 40% of the weapons sent to Ukraine are not making it there. I find this disturbing and would like to see this discussed in more detail. Where do these weapons go after they leave the U.S.? Who is shipping these weapons, the military or a contractor? Where are they being lost? Who is supervising this operation, et cetera? This could be a topic for an entire show. Not only am I concerned about foreign terrorists getting a hold of these arms, I'm concerned about Trump supporters getting their hands on these weapons. Thank you.
I wonder if KGNU listeners are aware that yesterday, September 26th, is Stanislav Petrov Day. Never heard of him? Well, Stanislav Petrov is probably the reason you're alive today. In 1983, he was a lieutenant colonel in the Soviet Nuclear Air Defense Forces, and the equipment detected 6 incoming missiles from the U.S. It was a false alarm in violation of Soviet nuclear protocol. He said no and wouldn't launch the missiles. So this guy is an ordinary hero, and we can thank him, I can thank him anyway, for my existence today.
If you'd like to make a comment on something you heard on KGNU, you can leave a message at our listener comment line at 303-447-9911. That's all the time we have for today's Morning Magazine. Thanks to Luis Licon, Eric Galatis, Alexis Kenyon, and Sam Fuqua for their contributions to today's program. I've been your host, Shannon Young. Stay tuned for How on Earth. That's coming up after the news headlines from the BBC.